supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. On both coasts of the United States today, armed gunmen caused terror and mayhem. In Virginia, a man opened fire on a congressional softball practice, seriously injuring one congressman and several staffers. And in San Francisco, a shooting at a UPS warehouse has left four people dead, including the shooter. Inevitably, talk will focus on how to prevent such tragedies. One team of engineering students at Drexel University is proposing an innovation that could help. After winning a Drexel design competition, the team is looking to manufacture a system of bulletproof curtains dubbed the Ballistic Curtain Cordon System. Joining me now to talk about it is team leader James Ostman. James, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Dave.
You and one of your team members, Daniel Navin, have a military background, right?
Yes, Dan was an infantry sniper who served in Iraq in 2009. I'm still currently an officer in the Pennsylvania National Guard. I served multiple deployments, one in Afghanistan in 2010 and a deployment previously in 2008.
So to what extent is your knowledge of the use of guns useful in utilizing this product? And let's talk specifically about a school setting.
Okay, well, one of the primary takeaways from our experience in combat, when in the installations we had what were referred to as T-walls, and essentially these were concrete barriers that were dispersed throughout the installation, and what they were designed to do was to take wide open spaces and basically compartmentalize them into smaller spaces. What they did was they essentially took away that direct line between danger and the people that it was designed to protect. The ballistic curtain cordon system essentially does exactly that. It takes wide open spaces like a hallway or something of more defined dimensions like a classroom and takes its wide open nature and essentially compartmentalizes it into smaller spaces through the addition of partitions that essentially drop from the ceiling.
So it would be deployed rather instantaneously with a push of a button.
That's right. Triggered much like a fire alarm. An electromechanical system deploys these curtains upon command. I think an important aspect of it is that you can train with it. You can drill with it. You can actually build that muscle memory of survivability and instill that within the people that it's designed to protect.
James, is the idea ultimately to buy more time for outside police deployment to come in and subdue the suspect?
We absolutely see it as a second chance system. It obviously creates that barrier to buy those extra moments needed in those situations. So whether that provides that awareness or that presence of mind to actually make that flight in order to survive, I think that it does effectively create that. But if anything, even its presence, we believe, would act as a deterrence for these situations to even occur in the first place.
So now let's get into, as this is a real manufactured product, let's get into the cost per curtain and how many curtains would it take to sufficiently outfit a typical high school, for example.
The average high school that was researched was about 53 rooms, and if you also consider the amount of square footage and hallways, we prognosticated about 75 curtains per school at a cost of about $250,000.
I saw a breakout showing how expensive it is when, God forbid, a school shooting takes place in terms of what subsequently has to happen. And $200,000 seems like the biggest bargain by contrast. Yet, to make the case to a school to do that initial investment in the face of, say, here in Philadelphia, where there are real budget problems, can't be an easy sell.
Well, since Columbine, the schools have been spending upwards of $900 million a year in terms of upgrading their security efforts. Unfortunately, most of these efforts centers around door locks and credentials and ID badges and things of that nature. And what you will find is the common theme in most of these events is that the people who conduct these atrocities had already had access and already had a right to be in that facility in the first place. So essentially, those efforts, those means in which they are bolstering security just don't work.
You know, we can talk about the cost, but ultimately it's about keeping people safe. would there be sufficient curtains to designate, say, an entire room so that students, teachers, administrators, etc., could be safe for the duration of the time it takes to subdue the suspect?
One of the design aspects is what we call the corner safe haven. Essentially what it does is it takes the two converging walls at a corner of a room and essentially blocks it off from one wall to the other, essentially creating a corner of armored protection. When the partition drops and essentially blocks that corner away from the exterior of its containment, the occupants from within can essentially secure that partition to the floor, controlling who comes in and who goes out. And that offers them options in terms of remaining in place behind the safety of the armored curtain or possibly escaping out a window that's enclosed behind that partition.
Have you foreseen applications beyond schools?
It really is geared towards any facility or any stakeholder who has an expectation of safety or sanctity wherever they go. It's for essentially any place of gathering. We've identified hospitals, military installations, government offices, airports, concert venues. All of these areas are relevant because they're all places that any patron or any person would have a reasonable expectation of safety when they were there. And that's essentially everybody that we're marketing to.
Congratulations on the four of you graduating Drexel University, and good luck moving forward with your project.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to recognize the Drexel College of Engineering, the Department of Mechanical Engineering and Electrical College of Engineering.
And you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
The jury in Bill Cosby's criminal trial is rounding out its third day of deliberations with more questions. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has more from Norristown.
For its sixth question since deliberations began, the jury requested to hear more testimony from a detective who interviewed Bill Cosby. They've already repeated testimony by the alleged victim, Andrea Constand, and some past statements by Cosby. Deliberations have now lasted longer than many in recent Montgomery County history. That's causing some to speculate that the jury is deeply divided. After a break for hot stromboli dinner, deliberations will resume over whether or not to convict Cosby of criminal sexual assault. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Now, some 24 hours into deliberations over the past 3 days, jurors in the Bill Cosby sexual assault trial have yet to reach a verdict. Let's consider the potential of a hung jury with Mark Fury, criminal trial defense attorney out of Mount Holly, New Jersey. Mr. Fury, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Are there specific stresses on this jury because of the notoriety of the case?
I'm sure there are. It's always a challenge when you have a popular or well-known person because they walk into the courtroom with even a greater presumption of innocence than a normal person does.
And that they've been sequestered for the duration now. This is day 8. That must take it's a special burden, too.
It works both ways. Some jurors will be wanting to get it over with, and I'm sure the large majority will be wanting to take their job very seriously. They've invested a lot of time and gone to a lot of headache and heartache to sign up for this job, so I'm sure they want to do a good job.
What leeway does the judge have to urge them to come to a decision?
Typically, if they come back the first time and say they're having trouble coming to a unanimous decision, a judge will give them an additional instruction telling them to do their best efforts, to not sacrifice their own judgment, but try to work with the others and change their judgment if they find it to be erroneous.
We're speaking with you in part because of your extensive experience with criminal jury trials. I understand you presided over one where there was a hung jury in a murder trial.
In fact, that particular case, I hung it twice, 2 times in a row.
Was there anything applicable with that jury that you think might also apply to the one out in Norristown today?
I think in every case where a hung jury is a potential, it comes down to the facts. If the facts are clear, there shouldn't even be a trial. It should have been resolved. So we only want to try cases where the facts are not clear. In this case, where it really comes down to literally he said, she said, Mr. Cosby's testimony given through his deposition versus Ms. Constance's testimony on the witness stand, the jury has every possibility of hanging because some may believe one and some may believe the other.
Any sense whether these jurors are particularly conscientious versus the possibility that one of them is quite obstinate in his or her beliefs. We know that the jury has gone back to the judge for subsequent clarification any number of times.
The questions have been interesting. I think they could be read as possibly favoring Mr. Cosby a little bit. I think that whenever you have juror questions, it shows that they're really trying to do a good job.
What the jurors don't know is allegations that were revealed yesterday about a alleged co-worker of the plaintiff who says that there were other reasons for wanting to pursue the case.
I did hear something about that. There was a press conference on the courthouse steps, as I understand it. Mr. Cosby's spokesman suggested that a former co-worker of Ms. Constance had made the comment that she was going to, quote, set Bill Cosby up. It's not a fact that's before the jury. It's not something that will be considered. If it turns out to have any veracity at all, it may be something that's subject to an appeal or an application for a new trial should Mr. Cosby be convicted on any of the counts.
And that's precisely what my next question would have been, that this was at the discretion of Judge O'Neill to not permit it into evidence. Would that be, in and of itself, basis for an appeal?
I am certain that that will be the main basis for appeal. I will say this. I always like to tell people that trials are just like boxing matches, and the defendant walks in with the title of innocent until proven guilty. And you can't take that title away from a defendant unless you beat them firmly. That's why it has to be unanimous. That's why it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. So if it turns out to be a hung jury, it's not something that people should be upset about the system. It means the system is working properly.
Mark Fury, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's my honor.
Mark Fury, criminal trial defense attorney based in Mount Holly, New Jersey. How do you talk to your children about racism and inequality? A new program helps African-American families have honest conversations about these tough issues and work on their coping skills. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports.
When Barbara Ellis was younger, growing up in small-town West Texas, she remembers dancing with a white friend.
And some of his friends were saying horrible things to him for dancing with me. And he kept that from me. I don't think he told me for like a year.
But when she did find out, it was hard for her family and friends to have a larger conversation about the painful experience.
Those weren't conversations that we had. It was just, you know, that person is awful and just forget about it.
Ellis just finished the Embrace program with her 13-year-old son, Pierce. It's a 5-week program that includes individual and family therapy. The program unpacks common responses to a racist world and gives families different tools that can help them cope better. Rihanna Anderson, Embrace's developer and director, says kids who aren't prepared often bottle up frustration and anger.
You're going to internalize quite a bit and think about all the things you did wrong, what it is about me as a person, rather than this is what this person sees about a whole group of people.
So part of helping kids process racist acts or prepare for them is an exercise families do in sessions, thinking up comebacks.
The racial comebacks are a way of saying, in a sense, I know you are, but what am I?
But before people come up with their comeback they might really use, they get a chance to say the first thing that would come to their mind. And that can be really unfiltered. Then they get a chance to think about what would actually work well for them in that situation. That's usually more tempered and assertive. Anderson has a comeback of her own. Let's say somebody says to her that there's no need to talk about race because we live in a post-racial society.
So the comeback to that is, oh, when were we racial? And just ending it there. Because people will ask you, like, you know, haven't we already dealt with this? Isn't there a time in history? And they'll try to put it on you. So then I just like to come back and say, like, well, what is it? When is it that we did do this? Can you tell me?
During the classes, 13-year-old Pierce thought about a painful situation that happened recently. While he waited for his mom to pick him up from orchestra practice one night, he saw a man on the street with his wife.
And he pulled his wife, fiance, closer and was like, let's hurry up. I don't want to get robbed. And he was looking right at me. So, and I was like the only person there. So I felt like that was directed towards me.
His mother says her first instinct as a parent would be to either go into advocacy mode or parrot the responses she used to hear as a kid.
What I would have said was, oh, you know, don't listen to him, or, you know, just which erases his emotions in that moment.
What she found out through the program was that those responses made Pierce feel like she didn't totally see him. She shifted her response to a more curious, how do you feel and what would you like to do about it? And Pierce says he's noticed the change. So he thought about the fact that in reality, he had cause to be afraid. He was carrying an expensive viola on his back. So what's the result of thinking up that comeback with the knowledge that his mom supports his emotional reaction?
I think it makes me feel more, like, supported in, like, what I'm doing, like, knowing that, like, getting, like, reassurance that, like, knowing that I didn't do anything wrong.
The hardest week for Barbara Ellis was the one where the program touched on police killings of unarmed Black men and the kinds of conversations she'll have to have with her sons.
Just to even have to have that conversation with my 13-year-old. When I think about it, it makes me want to cry.
She says Embrace helped her shift from conversations like this.
I've heard it said, and I think it's kind of common within Black families, just do what you need to do to come home.
To exercises where kids can actually talk through these possibilities with their families and what they could reasonably do. They talk about how to advocate for oneself and how to not feel continually disempowered.
I think that that's more hopeful for me, as opposed to conversations where it's just always kind of shrouded in a level of fear.
Rihanna Anderson agrees. She acknowledges that there are so many things that are beyond someone's control and that no one can really know if a situation is ever fully safe. But she says that what her program can do is help families assert their voice. And that in itself is powerful. Anne Hoffman, WHYY News.
A panel of Pennsylvania appeals court judges finds Philadelphia's 1.5 cents per ounce tax on soda and other sweetened drinks is legal. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports.
The ruling is a major victory for Mayor Jim Kenney, who summed up his reaction this way.
Joyous. Two judicial venues now where we've prevailed.
In December, a lower court rejected the soda industry's argument the city was illegally taxing consumers on food stamps and doubling down on items already subject to the state's sales tax. Today, 5 out of 7 Commonwealth Court judges upheld that ruling. Since the tax is levied on beverage distributors, not retailers, the industry's argument doesn't hold water, the majority said. Kenney says the legal challenge has been holding up the projects the tax was passed to fund. That includes subsidized pre-K and major renovations at city parks, rec centers, and libraries.
We're hoping that the beverage industry will understand that this is going to be in place to stay and let's allow our kids to get what they need right now as opposed to waiting another 4, 5, 6 months.
But the industry isn't budging. The American Beverage Association is planning to appeal to the state Supreme Court. In the meantime, spokesman Anthony Campisi says it's keeping up the anti-tax campaign.
Families and consumers are paying more. And at the same time, exactly like we've been saying all along, this tax isn't a sustainable source of revenue for the city.
So far, the tax has brought in about $26 million, less than the city had hoped for by now. A Kenney spokesman says the administration is lowering its projections for the first 6 months, but is confident the tax will generate the $90 million a year promised going forward. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
A world premiere production in Center City, Philadelphia of the play How to Use a Knife is set inside the kitchen of a workaday restaurant. The real action isn't with the food, it's in the kitchen itself. WHYY theater critic Howard Shapiro saw the show and offers this review.
How to Use a Knife comes at you like a play on speed, or maybe a play with no speed limit. Here, in the first 2 minutes of dialogue, is a cook responding to a busboy.
You got a big mouth, my friend, but I got a bigger knife. Now take the food out like a good boy.
Just come on, guys, sisters.
Yeah!
That crescendo from the start made me wonder how much more intense Will Snyder's play could become. And as it turns out, the answer is a lot, and often in the quiet of the night after the restaurant is closed. The play has 7 characters. You just heard 2 of them. Jay Hernandez as a cook and Trevor William Fail as the busboy. But the 2 guys who really count in How to Use a Knife are the men with their own demons, the chef and the dishwasher. The tempestuous chef can be outrageously nasty and also strangely contemplative. And he's played by the veteran Philadelphia-based actor Scott Greer, who excels in comedy and more in drama. He's taken this job as a new start after struggling with addiction and the person it had turned him into. The dishwasher is an immigrant who says almost nothing to anyone, and his past as a freedom fighter in the midst of violence in Rwanda haunts him. He's played with quiet fortitude by Lindsay Smiling. The 2 men enter into a guarded friendship as they explore each other's past.
What did you do? Look, I don't judge. Knuckleheads, illegals, jailbirds, we got people from all walks of life, but there's something about you, some discipline. What is it?
You are a man who has had a very tough life.
Yeah, what's your point?
You know what it is to hurt. You want to do yourself harm.
Yes, so what?
We are brothers in this respect.
Smiling and Greer give performances so solidly real and in the moment, you wonder whether they had a script for all this. The production is smooth as could be under the direction of Interact Theater's leader, Seth Rosen. It's what's called a rolling world premiere. The new play opens in different productions in different cities. Interact is the fourth and last company for this premiere, but I'm sure the play will make the rounds in theaters across the country. It's a rich and frequently funny look at the nature of friendship and a tough consideration of what happens when you believe that my demons are far more unthinkable than yours. The Interact production of How to Use a Knife runs through June 18th at the Proscenium Theater inside the Drake on Spruce Street. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
That was Newsworks Theater blogger Howard Shapiro. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.